Hey folks, it's From The Vault, episode number 11. So this week on the main feed, we did video Kerrang! Volume 6, which is from April 1998. I thought in order to compliment that, I'd go back to the first ever episode we did on Cover Mounts, where we actually spoke about the history of the Cover Mount CD. So if you haven't heard that before, this will be a really good chance for you to kind of get a bit more familiar with how these Cover Mount CDs worked and some of our theories as to why they are structured the way they're structured and all that. So yeah, I think this is really illuminating. Hope you enjoy it. Hey folks, welcome to the Unsung Podcast. I was going to make a joke about new metal there, but my mind went completely blank, sorry.
That's what new metal does to you.
Just erased your brain.
It's trauma.
Should I start scatting?
You should start therapy, is what you should do, and it'll slowly tease out all the things that your body desperately tried to damp down.
Therapy question mark?
Bastard, I was going to say that.
Yeah, start therapy live. That'll make more sense later on in this special, of the Unsung Podcast. Mark, what's the Unsung Podcast?
The Unsung Podcast is a podcast where we talk about classic albums that we think are great and bands that we think are shite.
So, Mark, 4 years in, that's a terrible summation.
No, I was only pattern, mate, for fuck's sake.
Terrible pattern.
So the Unsung Podcast is where we talk about bands that we think deserve to have more appreciation for the general public, or we talk about records which need to have more appreciation from bands that are huge. And sometimes we just talk about complete pish because people give us money to do it.
Now he's talking the truth. We have company this week. Our main man Dave Weaver is in the saddle.
Hi there.
And our other main man Craig is in the saddle down under. What do they call a saddle in Australia?
A saddle. Yeah, I don't know, horse seat, something like that. How are you boys? Nice to hear your dulcet tones. I think you're getting more Scottish as these weeks have went on.
You just bring it out in us.
Yeah, pretty much. I haven't been out of Scotland for 2 years, so I don't have any cultural input from elsewhere.
I just did my first bit of travel in a couple of years, and but travelling with the COVID restrictions is a pain in the arse.
Yep.
Everywhere you go.
Do what England did.
Just pretend it's over.
It's over. It's done. It's gone. Well, Craig, you're on with us this week, apart from the fact that you're a top guy with loads of chat, because the subject of this week's show is something that we've been teasing for a while, and it really came from a suggestion you made quite some time ago. It was on the subject of cover mounts, cover mount CDs, cover mount tapes, cover mount compilations, and it wouldn't have been right for us to do this without getting you involved. Firstly, because you're going to have plenty of input, and secondly, because Mark's got none, so we need to make a substitution. I don't know, Mark, I don't know what you were doing with your youth that you somehow missed out on the
phenomenon. How did you listen to music? How did you find out about new bands?
So I did actually buy Kerrang! And Metal Hammer and stuff.
TikTok.
I wish I was that young. Don't fucking tease me. No, I did buy Kerrang! And Metal Hammer, but I just read them and then go out and buy the records. The cover mount CD thing. Maybe it was a bit, I don't know.
Did you grow up rich, Mark? Are you rich?
Absolutely not. I would buy them. I'd buy copied versions in school.
I can vouch for the fact he's a mink.
For me personally, this was the only way I could hear new bands, because I couldn't go out and buy 18 albums of bands I read about. You know,
I just picked one or two. You know,
what confuses me is that the discs were stuck to the front of the magazines. It wasn't a matter of choice. Did you not wonder why the magazines were so heavy that week? the disc was stuck to it.
Obviously, I'd seen them. They just weren't a part of my musical upbringing. I just never listened to them.
You're a literature man, aren't you?
That is true. But no, I never.
Yeah, your cover mount novellas on Literature Today.
Yeah,
totally. The cover mount CDs and the Reader's Digest were shite. Okay, well,
the free books were good though.
So we're going to do two things with this show. The first part of the show is we're going to just talk about the phenomenon of cover mounts, mainly for Mark's sake. You're going to be a proxy for the ignorance of the world.
Yep.
And we're going to look into a wee bit of the history and just generally swap some thoughts on it, because it's actually pretty interesting. I mean, all these things at first glance seem like they could be a bit dry until you really dig into them and you're like, shit, that's kind of fascinating how that works. We'll do that, and that's going to be episode one. And in episode two, we decided to try something a bit different, and I think what we've realised is it's going to set the tone for something that will become a semi-regular feature in the show. We're going to take a cover mount CD, in this case, and we're going to sort of review it. We're going to go through it track by track, as we maybe would a normal album. There's obviously far more bands involved, so we'll see what we find. We'll find the people that vanished, the people that went on to great success, some of the highlights, some of the lowlights. We're all going to pick... at the end of episode two, a good, the bad and the ugly of that record, our favourite, our least favourite, and one that's some anomaly. It's kind of fascinating, maybe, or it's very unusual, or, you know, there's something noticeable about it. So that'll be part two. Part one, this is the documentary episode. You've seen it before with the Black Metal mixtape or the Riot Girl mixtape. We do a little bit of a history lesson, and we're going to make it interesting. Mark, is there any office work you want to get out the road before
yes,
I get stuck in?
I do have some office work. First of all, I want to say a big thank you to Todd Cool. Is that how you say his name? Anyway, he's part of the Vinyl and Digital Record Club.
He's a premium chap.
Is he called Todd Cool?
Todd Cool?
Yeah.
Yeah, he is very cool. And Power, they subscribe to us.
Thank you, Power. Yep. An excellent organisation doing excellent work in Scotland for women's representation in music.
Yeah, and Roshan Bahita, thank you for joining us as well. So, yeah, that's some of the admin out of the way. And we also recently put up a bonus episode, so if you want to subscribe even at the lowest tier, which is £4, or whatever the equivalent is in your local currency, you'll get access to what is now 18 bonus episodes.
Yeah,
which is pretty cool.
The last one's really good. It's a town hall sort of, it's a mixtape Christmas leftovers, the questions we didn't get round to in the Christmas specials because we were gubbed, and yeah, some fine patter within. And we've also started sending out the Unsung Record Club records
all over the world,
all over the planet, actually. Have a look on the website, get involved in that. It's really good. We have a box of some tremendous stuff here already. A bunch of people are going to be going down to answer the door to the mailman, and they're going to get this lovely surprise. You could be one of those people, and we promise it'll be worth your while, and it'll help us out at the same time, because we want to keep doing this. So, let's just dive in. What are cover mounts? Okay, cover mounts come in different forms. We're mainly talking about something called flexi-discs, which we'll go into, cassettes, and CDs. Now, what you'll probably realise is, given that it stops at CDs, I don't think it even got as far as mini-discs. Anybody ever see a mini-disc cover mount?
No, I don't think so.
Never.
No. So, given that it stops at CDs, cover mounts are very much a thing of the past. Or, that's not strictly true. I thought they were, and it turns out there is a sort of ironic retro value appreciation of cover mounts now, in the same way as there might be for Chuck Norris movies or
Tom Selleck's mustache.
There you go. We'll get to that as well. Why are we discussing them? Because especially for I would say white males our age, people our age, but in this case white males our age, they were really influential.
Mostly.
Apart from Mark. And actually quite exciting, I think, for a lot of us. As Craig says, there was an economic aspect to that, in that they were the only way that some people got to hear certainly a bunch of new things at one time, other than terrestrial radio, which in the UK wasn't that great. And they were the precursor to playlists. Playlists have basically inherited the title. That is where publications and people and bands curate new artists. And there's a whole load of politics and a whole load of interest and dynamics behind those as well that really parallel a lot of things that were going on with cover mounts, and we'll look at those too. Dave, cover mounts a big part of your childhood?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I guess it was just that sort of pre-internet era of getting something that wasn't the radio, that was curated to an extent, and dependent on what magazine you were buying, or, you know, what sort of journal you were after, you knew a general sort of genre that you'd be getting, but it would be a bit of a mix of what you'd be getting. Yeah, for me, I think my first ever Kerrang! Magazine had a cover mount CD on it, And it just opened my eyes to a whole load of stuff. When was that? I was probably 13. And then just over the next 7 or 8 years, whether it was Kerrang or Metal Hammer, Terrorizer, and then even like later on, I was getting like Mix Mag. And yeah, it was just a really interesting, good introduction to a whole load of shit that I'd only ever have been able to read about in the reviews, and then, you know, HMV and Inverness might not have had, or what have you. So yeah, it was like, it was pretty vital for me, you know, in the pre-broadband era, because the only other way to find these tunes were to go on LimeWire or Napster and spend an hour and a half downloading one track. And then it turns out it's not even a track, it's a fucking demo of Wolfenstein or something.
That's what I did. That's exactly what I did.
Aye. Like, I do remember moving on to the, you know, the file sharing stuff. And with that, it was very much a, okay, what do I know? So I'll go on and download it. But with cover mount CDs, you know, you had 15, 20 tracks and you might only know 3 or 4 of the bands, and then the rest was an education.
So Craig, before I ask your experience with them, I want to pick up on one interesting theme there. And you're talking about being exposed to other things, and that's definitely not a feature of modern music as much. Things are so easily skippable, and so much about algorithms tailors your listening experience to your existing tastes already, you know, with some variation, but not always a huge amount. And one of the things about cover mounts was that you were more or less forced to grapple with a whole host of stuff. You knew you weren't going to like it all. You knew, in fact, there's probably stuff in it you were going to absolutely detest. But you were forced to wrestle with this music that you weren't otherwise necessarily going to spend any time with. And it did produce the odd, surprising result. And I think that kind of mirrors that old attitude to albums anyway, where you could only get one album a week or one album a month, depending on your background and your circumstances. And as a result, you know, Trent Reznor's spoken about this, we've mentioned it on the show before, you had to really grapple with the album tracks as well. You wanted to get your the most for, you know, the bang for your buck, and you really dug into things and spent more time, and it gave the artists a bit more scope. Well, these magazines were putting things together that wouldn't fit together on any logical sort of mix cassette you would give your friends and stuff, but it did force you to hear new things, and sometimes some of them just, you know, they just stayed with you, and that actually was really good for broadening your horizons in a way.
Yeah, I'm just getting to draw a line in my head, and it's, I think what I was doing is looking at like the good reviews and Kerrang and Metal Hammer, downloading a track from those albums, and then I'd put them on a mixed CD, and I'd listen to that on the way to school endlessly, to the fact my mum hated me because I was playing the same fucking like 10 tunes on repeat.
Aye, Mark, that's why your mum hated you.
Oh, you know.
You keep telling yourself that, son. Yeah, absolutely, I know what you mean. And I did enjoy file sharing when it came around, but file sharing, they weren't foisted upon you, and then you weren't locked in a sort of metaphorical room with them for a month until the next one came along. You know, you could just ditch it. You could get 10 seconds into it and ditch it. Whereas with this, if you put the disc on, you weren't necessarily going to stand up and skip every tune. You would just let it play. And after 3 or 4 listens, the head PE song might start to make sense to you if you're Craig, or you know, something decent might start to make sense to you. There are tracks on the compilation we'll cover in the second part of this show, there are tracks on that I really didn't like at first listen, and then after half a dozen I was really into them, and then ended up getting really into the bands. Craig, what about you? How did they feature for you? I imagine it was similar to me.
Yeah, I'm only about 25 years younger than you, but for me, like, you know, coming from a small town, Scotland or whatever, it was an economical thing. I didn't have a CD player till quite late as well. Little aside, I remember I got one of those little kind of bubble, like, stereo things with a CD player on the top and a single deck in the front. And the only two CDs that I had were The Best of Fats Domino, which is fucking awesome, and Raga Jam, which had the first track was O Carolina by Shaggy, and then like Iron Lion Zion and Sweat a la 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 long. So
I didn't shape who you are.
And yeah, cover mount CDs were just a way for me to hear lots more music. And I think people of our generation, Chris, we were kind of trained in this with things like Now That's What I Call Music, things like that, these compilations where they might have had some absolute world-class bangers on them, but there was a lot of shite on there as well that you'd never hear of again, one-hit wonders and even less than that.
For every Hadaway, there was a...
And I'm still questioning, what is love? What is love?
I never know.
But yeah, these Covenant CDs were super vital. I still haven't really got into the whole file sharing thing. I think I kind of just missed that because I didn't really have internet. Internet was just kind of coming up. Like, I'm of this generation where it's a weird generation where we grew up without phones and then with phones. I think I had my first mobile phone at maybe 18 or something like that. So you had to like meet your pals near a phone box just to find out if they were coming or not, things like that, you know.
Aye.
And it's a very strange, I don't know what the letter is with the gen of it, you know, but it's a very interesting thing where, you know, we lived without mobile phones and then we
suddenly had them.
And Covenant CDs are a wee bit like that, where I didn't have enough money to go and buy every album that I read about, but when you hear these Covenant CDs, and it's very obvious when I was looking at the collections, we've been sharing them in the Unsung AAA Facebook thing, and so many of them just jumped out, and you can almost tell the tracks that are so vital and so good that made me lifelong fans of some bands, and then there's utter dirge.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite interesting now, looking back at it, looking at what happened to those bands and why.
Oh, you know? Definitely. Isn't it quite interesting as well, the dynamic where your friends would be discussing the cover mount from that month like it was a community thing? You know, if you were in the metal community, oh, did you get the new Kerrang? Did you listen to track 7 on that compilation? What do you think of the X band? And you would sit at the pub talking about it. Oh, did you get that one? Did you get that one? And that was a kind of communal experience where so many of these went out, and certain magazines in particular were so popular that it would become something that everybody had in common, you know, which is not really something that can be said even of Spotify playlists.
And that became an event as well, because... If you had, say, a group of pals who were into heavy music or rock music kind of thing, I might say, Chris, are you going to buy that album, or I'll buy this one, and then we'll swap, or you can tape it or burn it or whatever.
I don't know
that
about you as well.
Thing as well.
I don't know about you guys, but at least a few of these cover mount CDs, I didn't buy the magazine, shall we say.
Cheeky. How else were you going to get your poster of Nadia from Cold Chamber, though?
That's true.
If you didn't buy the magazine.
That's true. Right, so, see, before we get too far down the whole of our own personal experiences of it, we'll come back to some of our thoughts. I just want to do a wee history lesson, right? So I mentioned a word really early on that definitely needs to be addressed for a lot of listeners. Flexi-discs. And cover mounts kind of started with flexi-discs, okay? So before the advent of compact discs, flexi-discs were used as a means to include sound with printed materials, magazines, including music instruction books. So it was actually quite a good way to let a student hear how something should be played, along with showing them the sheet music. It was a really, really good kind of multi-format educational tool. Mm-hmm. Flexi-discs could be really cheaply bound inside a publication using a little perforated seam. They weren't quite paper thin, but they were very, very thin, and you could just tear it off down the perforated seam. In fact, one problem with the flexi-discs was that they were so light, and the stylus in a record player was so heavy comparatively, that the discs would sometimes stop spinning and just drag round with the stylus. So they used to have, a lot of them had on them a little specific demarcated place, usually drawn on them or something, for you to put something like a coin or a weighted object to make the needle actually run round them, because they were groove cut like vinyls, but they were very, very, very thin, as we say, wobbly. For example, some of the early uses of flexi-discs in the UK, Private Eye magazine, which is a political satire magazine over here, released audio on flexi-discs throughout the 60s.
Aren't we in danger of forgetting the real meaning of Christmas? Namely, the miraculous birth of a magister in a lonely stable in Balmoral? If this is their decision, the three wise men need their heads examined.
Although the term cover mount wasn't really used at the time, I think the term flimsies was one that people used to use back then, and that obviously has to do with how sugary and thin these things were. Some of the discs in question in Private Eye featured satirical sketches by people like Dudley Moore, Peter Cook, Barry Humphreys, stuff like that.
And now Malcolm Muggeridge asks the question, how much?
How much?
We'll be back with you in a moment.
Yes, new instant Robert Maxwell dissolves overnight.
Robert Maxwell.
More like a radio show, less music. Come the 70s, NME, New Musical Express, big magazine, big influential music magazine in the UK, did start issuing these 7-inch flexi discs. Although flexi discs were usually just used as occasional giveaways, from 1980 to 1982, Flexi Pop magazine was specifically named after the format and made it a speciality of giving away discs with each edition that contained the artists they were going to talk about or interview. I saw one guy as well, we're talking about how flimsy these things are, one guy in a discussion board lamenting yesterday, I remember a kid at school having the issue of Flexi Pop with the Adam and the Ants Flexi, and he removed the sellotape, fixing it to the cover, and it blew away across the playground. Than some girl stood in it. Which just is like a mad thing to think of, that you had something that had music embedded on it and a gust of wind could just take it away. But it was really innovative at the time. They were all over the place as well. Japan had them starting in the early 60s, as early as us at least. A publishing house called Asahi Sonorama published this monthly Asahi Sonorama magazine with what they called sono sheets, which were, just, collections of music to go along with it. And in the Soviet Union, of all places, flexi discs were really important, but in a strange way. They were mass-produced from 64 through to 1991, the fall of the Soviet Union, inserted into these magazines for teens called Krugozor. Sort of state-sanctioned kind of teen entertainment. I'm sure it was all very austere. In 1969, the government of the Soviet Union also launched an audio magazine for really young children, Kolobok, which contained flexi discs of, children's tunes, nursery rhymes, things like that, and I'm sure more than the odd song about the brilliance of the socialist government, communist government.
Знаем, слышим. Я просил тебя передать письмо и передать рано утром.
They were always really vivid blue, and apparently to this day are really familiar to anyone that grew up in the Soviet Union or even shortly afterwards when they were still circulating. Because of a shortage of vinyl in the Soviet Union, though, at the time, there's a really famous phenomenon of the Röntgenidsdat. Or the ribs,
the X-ray stuff,
or the bones, people, especially people that were trying to trade in music that was prohibited, which actually, to be fair, was also some quite mainstream music. They would take the X-rays out of dumpsters from behind hospitals, and then they would groove cut the X-rays. And so these are proper collector's items. We've spoken about them a wee bit in the show before in the Nexus, but yeah, you have these groove cut X-rays of records that were contraband in the USSR at the time, and this was how they circulated them. They only played so many times because of the way they were cut and because of the material, whilst it was durable enough to carry a song. I believe it was like, maybe 20 or so plays, and it started to deteriorate quite a bit. Some interesting flexi-disc trivia, if you can believe I'm saying that. Another fucking thing the fucking Beatles led the way with. Every year between 1963 and 1969, the Beatles made a special Christmas recording, which was made into a flexi disc and sent to members of their fan club. The early discs contained sort of thank you messages and things like that, but they started to experiment with the format a bit later. I think it was a 1970 disc had a pastiche BBC radio show and actually included a specially recorded song titled Christmas Time Is Here Again. And as you can imagine, those are mega collectible now. ABBA Live 77 was a special single-sided promo gold flexi disc. They were close enough and then every hour, every minute seems to last eternally. I was so afraid of Fernando. Given as a kind of bonus to children who sold magazines and books at Christmas for, now bear with me, for Jultenning Forlaget. I don't fucking have a clue how that should be pronounced, but they were basically a publishing company using door sales as their main distribution channel. The disc in question that was given to the kids as a thank you contained excerpts of ABBA's recent concert appearances in, of all places, Australia, Craig. What else do we have? A two-sided flexible sheet recording of the songs of humpback whales.
One of the loveliest nights I have ever spent at sea was on April 13th, 1970. It wasn't calm, and our little boat bowed and dipped...
Which was produced by a guy called Roger Payne, was included in the January 1979 issue of the National Geographic. With a production run of 10,500,000 copies, it became the largest single pressing of any record. What else? In 1992... Select magazine featured a Chris Morris flexi-disc. It was a satirical 7-minute thing from his early days just prior to the world falling in love with the day-to-day. It kind of lampoons that smashy and nicey type radio show. It has a brilliant tune in it, like a piss-take tune of the Pixies. So well done, but I mean, it's genuinely better than a lot of the later Pixies material, and it's about a mum spilling her tea on her son's corduroy trousers and then noticing that he's well hung. It's classic Chris Morris. And and another classic Chris Morris move, that is 7-minute flexi-disc also has a phone prank involving Piers Morgan, where Chris Morris phones him up pretending to be U2's manager, then puts Bono on the phone, inverted commas, to Piers Morgan to promote an exclusive story about their tour, their imminent split as a band, all following a new double A-side single that he announces to Piers is One Less Bitch, Find Them, Fuck Them and Flee.
How's it going?
I can't believe this.
Well, Paul and I were in the office this morning. We thought, who are we going to tell? Q Magazine? We thought, no, fuck them, and we thought the Sun print a no-nonsense approach, so why didn't we do that? They kind of appeal to our sense of humour as well, because they're like the turd of the music world, you know?
Fucking guy's amazing. Which, obviously, Piers Morgan buys totally wholesale. It's superb. And I think in 1990, last bit of trivia, the number one magazine gave away a free flexi disc of, do you remember Betty Boo? She did the track called The Anti-Smoking Rap. So as of like, as I said earlier on as well, as of 2010, there was a sort of kitsch value to these flexi discs, and Decibel magazine began releasing flexi discs again with each issue. I think it started actually in January 2011, and the content on each disc was, quote, 100% exclusive songs from the artists that had been featured. So again, extra collectible, a really novel sort of retro nod from Decibel. After flexi-discs, cover mounts started to evolve, and along came the computer magazines, because there was the explosion of home computing in the early 80s. The cover mount practice continued in that way. In the United Kingdom, computer hobbyist magazines began distributing tapes, cassette tapes, and then later floppy disks with the publications. This was a really big thing with the Amiga, also with like the Spectrum and the C64. The initial purpose of cover mounts was to distribute demo versions of video games, so like a bit of an advert, like a trailer for a film, as well as shareware applications, operating systems, wallpapers, and just other generally free content. You did get the occasional full game. I remember those cassettes.
Does Dave or Mark remember ever playing a computer game on a cassette?
Yeah, I had a Commodore 64. Yeah, I used to get the cassettes from the library and then copy them onto an actual cassette tape and then just play them.
Yeah, I never had a console, but my cousin had a Commodore. So yeah,
I had an Amiga as well, so those, like, I suppose that's actually more relevant to me. Like, those cover mount floppy disks, I've got more familiarity with them than I do.
That's mad.
My first computer was an Amstrad CPC 464.
Oh, green text.
Green monitor.
Yeah, I remember them.
And then I remember when I got an Amiga, it was like a big deal, and it was sponsored by Colin Curley, who was the mascot for Quavers the Crisps. It was like an Amiga 600 and the whole box came in. It was like this game that came, it was kind of like Colin Curley's adventure. It was so fucking crap.
We had one kid in the neighbourhood who had a C64 and we all used to go to his and play, and the amount of, I mean, the patience of children back in the day, because you had to wait half an hour on a level loading.
Yep.
Unbelievable. So one of the first cover mount games to be given away was in 1984, The Thompson Twins Adventure, which, by the way, I think is perhaps why the Thompson Twins were then chosen to appear in the Black Mirror
special.
The band,
the Thompson Twins, yeah?
Yeah. And the Thompson Twins themselves feature in Bandersnatch, the Black Mirror special. And I think it's a nod to the fact that they were the first full cover mount game. And by contrast, get this, in November 2015, Magpie magazine brought the concept full circle and attached a free Raspberry Pi Zero to the cover. So nice. It's the first full computer to be included the cover of a magazine.
That's pretty cool.
Insane, eh?
How much was the magazine, do you know?
Good question.
A Raspberry Pi's were only 15 quid, so it couldn't be that much.
Software, this was an interesting little detail, by the way. I know we're not here to talk about computers, but software added to a cover mount on computer magazines wasn't always secure. In the days before the internet connections were common, one of the fastest methods to spread a computer virus could be to accidentally include it on a cover disk.
Yep.
And although the disks were carefully scanned, there were cases of disks being distributed with viruses, which obviously harmed the reputations of the publications quite a bit. In several instances, the publishers had to explain that while the media were all scanned by antivirus software, the viruses were often too new or sophisticated to be recognised by that software. For example, in 1998, cover disks released by PC Power Play and PC Gamer were infected with a Marburg virus, which actually helped make that a really widespread threat, according to, you know, news channels, CNN and the like. And a Mac Addict cover disk in 2002 contained the Autostart worm. So, nothing to do with this podcast, but just interesting. There you go. Cover mount cassettes then crossed, you know, the divide from computers into music, became a slightly more affordable format. The Enemy had a long history with cassette releases, particularly famous were the C81 and the C86 releases, which are big collector's items now. But they were not actually cover mount releases. To obtain them, you had to send away two tokens, I think one from two copies of the magazine, effectively to show you'd bought it, plus a £1.50 postal payment, which in 1981 wasn't negligible. But it was still good value because you got this curated collection, and I think some of the stuff in it was quite exclusive. Other similar token cassettes included Pogo A Go Go, which was an Enemy 10th anniversary, a punk release. We've Come For Your Children, which was a really famous psychedelia collection, and also a selection of really rare Billie Holiday demos that the Enemy put out. You're in love, your hearts are flooding all day long. You only stutter across your poor tongue. Just will not out of the words I love you. At that point, the cassette medium wasn't quite cheap enough for the magazine to give them away. Later, free cover tapes did become a thing as the medium dropped in price. By the way, Mark, that Enemy coupon postal method was also the case for Capital Radio, the vinyl EP by The Clash. Once they dropped to an affordable level, many other magazines started to feature cassettes too. Select magazine had a few celebrated cassettes. There were some prominent releases by the likes of Kerrang, who had a Supersonic Volumes 1 and 2 thing that were pretty famous with some notable contributors. I remember kids in my school playing it and everybody kind of gathering around the tape machine to hear it. One particularly well-regarded cassette of that kind of like golden era of cover cassettes was the Chemical Brothers' Enemy Christmas Dust Up, the Dust Brothers Mega Mix, which was free with December 17th, 1994 issue of NME. It was mixed by the Chemical Brothers when they were still known as the Dust Brothers. We actually spoke about that like 2 episodes ago. Had some big tunes on it. The Chemical Brothers' Leave Home, The Prodigy's Voodoo People, and Manic Street Preacher's La Tristesse Durera.
Did it have Umbop on it?
No, should have.
The Dust Brothers did all the scratching on Umbop, you know.
You know how triggered I am by that song, Greg. You've seen many a person shout that at me across Friar Street and stuff.
Well, it's got some cred.
Now, I noticed in looking at some of the forums and people chatting about their favourite cover cassettes, I'd never read this magazine. I suspect some of our listeners might have, including Mr. Benella, but Lime Lizard seems like it had terrific free tapes. The 1993 Sub Pop one with Earth and the Fastbacks and the Dwarves. There's another 93 one with Tool and Henry Rollins. I saw an eclectic one with the likes of Censor, Dodgy, Eugenius, which is Eugene Kelly from the Vaseline's, and the Cardiacs on the same thing. And a really good one, which I would have just lapped up at the time, called Altered States of America, that had Jesus Lizard, Girls Against Boys, Polvo, Shudder to Think, Liz Phair, and Cop Shoot Cop. That magazine seemed like they really had it figured out, although I don't think the magazine actually lasted for very long. And then, although I think there was a little bit of overlap, but gradually cassettes gave way to CDs. The cover mount CD, which is where we're really going to get stuck into this. And this was the format, this was the optimum format for it, really. It would only go through one more real iteration of evolution, which was to become a multimedia CD. And then it would pass away, because as we say, I don't remember there being any mini discs. Although the cover mount CDs were tagged as free, cover mounts often increased the price of the magazine. We'll talk about that in a wee bit. Magazines that carried the discs could sometimes cost as much as double. The free labelling, though, on them was there to sort of discourage retailers removing the discs and trying to sell them separately. To prevent the discs getting stolen, the retailers sometimes kept them behind the counter. I probably played a wee bit of a part in that, sorry, folks. And then, get the button ready, because Mark, over to you. Prince. Yeah, Prince, yeah. And the big exclusive. Now, bands like The Faces had already used cover mounts to do exclusive advance listens to their albums. I think back in the early 70s, they'd used an NME cover mount to tease tracks off their new album. But Prince is very well known for offering studio albums free with various newspaper publications. His 2007 album Planet Earth was the first to be given this treatment in the United Kingdom in partnership with The Mail on Sunday. Boo hiss. Yeah. Mail on Sunday's controversial giveaway helped push the newspaper to record-busting sales. The newspaper's managing director at the time, Stephen Myron, said that 2.81 million editions of that issue were sold, which is eye-watering compared to what papers sell now.
That is the only time I ever bought that paper.
Really?
I bought it just for the album, because obviously everyone likes a bit of Prince, and kind of disappointed.
It's not very good.
You went in the bin with the paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly enough, then you must have been one of the additional 600,000 copies that they estimate they sold because of that. The publication apparently pressed up 3 million of the album at a cost of about £1 million, or at the time, I think closer to $2 million.
Sounds like something Prince would do it before.
Yeah. They did say that they got a number of calls from different artists following that, both music and film, about launching products in a similar way. And for them, the Mail on Sunday in particular felt it was a very exciting time for that. Prince's album 2010,
yep,
released in 2010 in Belgium under the same circumstances. Zero point approaches and the fields around you dry. Was it just Belgium?
No, it was in the Sun here as well.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, other publications across Europe then.
It's quite fun. That's quite a noble record for him, because not only is it garbage, but he stopped releasing albums for 4 years after that, which he'd never done before.
Yikes.
He released three albums, and then that's when he passed away 2 years later.
Talking about people that should have stopped releasing albums, pop rock band McFly released a cover amount album, their fourth record, Radioactive. Other artists known to release them are UB40, Peter Gabriel, Calvin Harris, and Soul Wax. In April 2007, EMI licensed the Mail on Sunday to cover Mount, and this is famous, 2.25 million copies of Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells, shortly before the rights to the album were due to revert to Mike. Something you can imagine he was very displeased
about. Widows.
Yeah.
What a fucking kick in the nuts.
They totally, like, man.
You are not selling this, Mike. We are going to strike a deal with the Mail on Sunday, get a wee bit of extra scratch, and to hell with you. So yeah, quite a long and storied history. I did notice, by the way, a little deviation. The PRS has an entire subsection and department devoted to licensing for cover mounts, and I will say, I won't bore you with the rates, but they did look quite expensive. The terms of it did look fairly prohibitive. Maybe it's changed now because it's less of a thing, but I can't imagine how it would be economical.
Did you see the thing about how if it's over 15 tracks, the rate goes up by like three times as much?
Yeah.
So there must have been some change in the coffers back then to actually get away with this.
I don't think the rates were the same back then. And I think this is what we're talking about, right? Because the methodology behind these is a little bit opaque. Now, just genuinely, like earlier on today, we found out about another podcast.
Yeah, the guys from We Dig Music. So I think they might even follow us or listen. Hello. Like, weirdly enough, I was looking to see if there was a playlist of the album that we're going to do next on Spotify.
Yep.
Searched on Spotify, and it turns out that they do a podcast on cover mount CDs. Mm-hmm. And the first one that they did was exactly the same as the first one we're going to do.
Which I think must be because it's a particularly interesting example of them because of the diversity in it. It's a really interesting collection of songs with like a lot of highs and a few total lows.
Yeah, I also just check out that podcast. Yeah,
yeah. I also just think that it's nostalgic for men of a certain generation.
Well, it definitely is. And I noticed that that podcast as well, they have so far been unable to really determine quite how the pricing in this works. This is kind of something we can only speculate on it at this point, but I would love to know how it worked. So, for example, like, were the discs maybe subsidised by the sort of lesser known bands that were on them? Did they maybe pay to get on them? That would seem like a model that would make sense both for their labels that were trying to break them, because it's a really desirable thing to do. And I do seem to remember when I was in my post-hardcore band back in Stirling, Craig, I think we did get a pitch about paying to get on something at some point, but it was really dear.
Well, I can imagine, like, you pay, I mean, I guess now you pay for, you know, radio pluggers and stuff like that.
I was going to say. Aye.
And bands would always have a bit of budget to plug. And then also, particularly like metal and stuff, you pay to get on tours.
Mm, absolutely, yeah.
So it's not, I can't see why it wouldn't necessarily be a thing.
So let's just pull a number in my arse, right? But let's say it was 10,000 quid to get on a Kerrang CD. That would probably represent pretty good value, wouldn't it? I mean,
at that time, I would think so. Yeah,
yeah, because you're probably getting like 50,000 to 100,000 folk buying that magazine every week. So yeah, you know, that's just getting that your band in front of those many ears. Pre-internet, how else are you going to do that?
Yeah,
you're not if you're a small new metal band from Stevenage, then that's literally the only way to do it.
Yeah, and then consider, scale that up. So you've then got, say you've got 15 tracks now, as we spoke about. Now, I'm going to set 5 aside for a particular reason, but you've got 10 other bands potentially paying 10 grand, right? So you're up to 100 grand. How much is that CD run really going to cost in that kind of quantity with the very simple cardboard sleeves or the very basic jewel design that they ended up doing a bit more often? You could probably cover certainly the pressing from selling the space to those acts. And then I would imagine, by extension, what you then want to do to try and make that space as desirable as possible is to invite 4 or 5 other artists on. Now we've got a strange one because the disc that we've done actually has a track devoted to an introduction, but that's an introduction that still has some sort of clout, which we'll talk about in part two. But the other four tracks or three tracks or whatever tended to be reasonably large names.
Yeah, there's not a lot of huge bands on these CDs. There's a handful of bands.
A handful, but that handful seemed pretty important.
I do remember, like, they used to do a best of at the end of each year, and that would be much more solidly filled with bands you'd heard of. Mm-hmm. But they'd maybe do like four or five a year, and usually it would be, yeah, five or six.
I think these
major label bands, then a couple of major label bands that you'd not heard of, but major labels were obviously pushing them, and then a few bands that were just like
stragglers.
Yeah.
It seemed very, very label-driven.
Yeah, I would say that.
These individual ones, like the one we're going to talk about, V2, is the kind of subsidiary of Virgin, seems to be the main one.
Yeah.
Obviously, the better ones for people of our taste and age is very Roadrunner-driven, things like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I guess these labels would have been taking out maybe a blanket buy and saying, okay, we've got your A-League bands here, but we're gonna need to try and break some of these kind of C-League bands as well. Mm. And that seems to be how it worked. So I imagine they must have had a blanket fee, and I wonder how much of that went to the artists, you know?
Yeah, one thing
if
I was...
something's like getting pressed like a million copies of a CD, that's like a dream for someone like Annie Christian or Idlewild or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But they're probably seeing nothing from that.
I was kind of wondering if maybe it was sold to bands as a package deal. Maybe they're also getting a video on Kerrang TV. Maybe they're also getting covered in a magazine in some capacity, whether it's just like a tiny column or a review of a live show. You know what I mean? It was probably part of a wider thing.
It's funny you mentioned that, Mark, because we were talking about curation earlier on, and obviously there was radio stations, and I think there was maybe one rock show or something that was on it after midnight on one station, like in the whole of the UK. And it wasn't until like MTV2 came in, because MTV at the time had things like Headbangers Ball, which were also on at like midnight and a Monday night and things like that.
Yeah.
But around this time, just as kind of I was getting internet as well, on people who had, I think my girlfriend at the time had Sky, and she had MTV2. And that was another curation kind of thing you would get. You would get all these songs, all the big hits that were on these government CDs. You would see the video for them as well, and just perpetuated that that kind of taste. Yeah. When did MTV2 come out? That would have been
97, maybe around, 98.
Something like 97, 98. And it was actually really quite cool back then. Well, to me it was.
Oh yeah,
I liked it.
All rock music.
Yeah, it had a house in here. Like, I'm gonna take a gamble, and I think it's a pretty safe one, that there was an incremental tightening of the operations of how these cover discs and cover tapes and then cover CDs worked, right? So I would say it was probably quite naively done early on. It was probably a sort of, can we afford to do this? Let's do it. Let's invite these acts. It's part of our brand. You know, we've got a good relationship with The Clash, or we've got a good relationship with Gorky's Zygotic Monkey or something. Let's ask them to do this. But then once, you know, as with like print media or any sort of branding, once people start to refine the format, they see opportunities to make money. So, I mean, you know, early on in gigs, you wouldn't imagine that bands were sent out with wads of tickets to sell to their grandparents to try and make money. That's something that evolved into music as, you know, the power balance shifted from the band to the people owning the venues or the big brokers of gigs and stuff that had big access to bigger acts and you wanted on the bills. So I would say this all evolved, and then as the magazines got more power, they were in a position to maybe sort of leverage a bit more and say, oh well, you know what, yeah, we used to invite people onto these discs, but now we sell it because it's premium, you know, now we can afford to charge. There was probably some, you know, brainstorming session where some ambitious intern said, why don't you just charge the bands to be on it now? And somebody's got, that's a good idea. And then that's become the norm. And then beyond that, they've been like, you know, it's got tighter and tighter and tighter, and they've got more and more efficient. And I think it's probably like that. I doubt very much that it landed ready formed as a.
Oh yeah, and I just imagine that like some of it will just be favors, and some of it, like when you're booking a big festival now, it's all about relationships and relationships with agents and stuff like that, and personal relationships between the booker and all that. And I can imagine here the editor, and they'll have had a commercial editor. You know, maybe
I think this is probably the start of the end for the music industry, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And it'll be like
pay to play thing. Yeah. So the term free music, you know, you're getting music for free by so, buying a magazine.
So even if it is going to cost a lot of money, it might be that, okay, Korn are going to launch their new single on the new Kerrang, so they are going to pay for 50% of the fee. You know, things like that might be a thing, because back in the day, they wanted as much sort of media coverage as possible, and getting that MTV2 premiere and getting a Kerrang CD with the, you know, with the cover as well. And they say, all right, and we're going to be the big exclusive front of the CD as well. New album, Korn. Everybody's very excited.
We'll, especially
we'll,
you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and then Sony will pay 50% of Kerrang's costs for that. I can imagine that being a sort of thing as well that might happen.
Possibly, but I actually also think that in that situation, the magazine would maybe still be beholden to a band that big. So you always had the sort of kickoff thing like Fear Factory or Megadeth or something like that. And I suspect that the magazine sort of said, do you want to be on this? And they sort of said, right, okay. And that was, if anything, probably just a gentleman's agreement sort of handshake thing. And then being on a cover CD with Fear Factory was then pitched to the smaller acts, and that was then part of where their price tag came from.
Aye, absolutely. You know what I mean? But they might be able to reduce that price tag if a major label is happy to pay for more of it.
And
the band, the CD that we're going to talk about in the next episode, I think pretty much launched a band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can imagine there was a big push by the marketing and the PR and the record label to say, yeah, this is, we're on the front of this. Yeah, so.
Yeah, which is the golden arrow that that everybody wanted from being on them. Yeah, and I agree with you about the relationships thing as well. You possibly had a big act on it, but then the agent or the manager or whatever saying, right, I'll give you them, whoever.
You're also taking two of my shitey ones.
Two of these ones. It's just like a festival, isn't it? So, yeah. But we should say, yeah, right, okay, so we are looking at this primarily from a rock and indie perspective because we're us. Arguably,
and a UK perspective as well.
And a UK
perspective.
To
see how this travelled globally.
Well, as I said, you know, earlier on, they were big in Japan and they did make an appearance in the Soviet Union. They were a thing in the United States. Just, I think the likes of Kerrang and stuff seem to have been particularly prominent in the history of them. Because even looking on forums, a lot of the input is from British listeners. Now, I would say that cover mounts were probably even more of a typical feature in the classical world. Classical magazines always have them. There's loads and loads of them. There's probably a ratio of 10 to 1 for every metal one that you can find. Likewise, jazz as well. Jazz magazines have a lot of them.
Jazz? Is that because of royalties? Not jazz mags, but yeah. Is that because of royalties? So so if you're playing a classical piece, say you're playing like a Bach piece or something like that, and you don't have to pay the royalties because it's expired.
Yeah, just performance royalties rather than... And even then, I don't think you'd even pay anything.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's a whole new world of financial dynamics that we can't possibly get our heads around. I'm sure it's fascinating. But that then moved on from those to the dance music scene. So Mixmag and Ministry of Sound had some huge mix CDs, like CDs that you would walk in somewhere and somebody would just put the mix CD on and it would be numerous bars and stuff would just have that mix CD playing in a loop constantly.
Aye, totally.
You would know what one it was, and they became quite synonymous. You also had some of the dance mags and some of the more techie mags started giving away discs that had samples on them for people that were mixing at home. You know, you could rip these samples off them. There are sometimes data discs, or remember we did it in the Pitch Shifter episode for www.pitchshifter.com. They had the track at the end of it that was just choppable sound samples for triggers and things like that. So it's hard to gauge whether featuring on a jazz mag cover disc had the same career making potential as, for example, featuring on a Kerrang disc, since they were more common. It very possibly did. It very possibly was the highlight of a lot of people's careers. But there's no denying that certainly in the world of rock and indie, it broke certain acts. From a personal perspective, I would say in my consciousness, Hot Snakes. Idlewild, the band Cold, which we'll come back to. Alice in Chains, probably Mogwai. Despite being Scottish, it was an NME compilation that featured the Mogwai track that first really captured my attention. Elliot Smith, I first really got into Miss Misery on an uncut cover mount CD, which was tunes from soundtracks, and that had been the closing credits of Good Will Hunting.
Good Will Hunting. A trip out of town to a place I've seen in a magazine that you left lying around.
and also Korn, Kerb Dog, Moby, Lodestar all came from that same series of Kerrang cassettes that I mentioned earlier on. I mean, what about you guys? Are there just a handful of bands that you can really remember?
One band that always popped up was, did they come after Kerb Dog? Was it Wilt?
Yes.
Do you remember them?
That was the band they became.
Yeah, Mondo Generator, remember that. I heard so many things that I would then go on to love for the first time, like Sepultura, I think I heard for the first time, Masters of Reality, the Workhouse Movement, remember that?
Oh God, yeah.
Suckers, yeah. Snake River Conspiracy, Amen, At The Drive-In, like Queens of Stone Age.
Super Suckers seem like a perennial cover my band, dude.
Totally. Group Dog Drill, do you remember them?
Oh, yeah.
By the way, Drilled, yes. That's Scott D.
I got one of their records recently, it's actually all right.
It's actually pretty. I was thinking about maybe taking it onto this show. What's funny is, like, you'd sort through the shit, or you would put it on, and you, like you said, you'd get used to some of the tracks, and you'd be like, oh, maybe I'm actually into, I don't know, KMFDM, and I wouldn't normally. But sort of Mixmag and stuff like that had been doing curated mixes. But I remember Kerrang then started doing the Refuse Music, or the. They would get people to fully curate. And I remember they did a garage rock one, which I think, was that done by The Kills or it had The Kills on it? Anyway, but then Casey Chaos from Amen did one. And that was one that fucking opened so many.
That's iconic, that one. It really is.
Because you weren't just dealing with record labels trying to punt post grunge. It was like, oh yeah, he put on The Birthday Party and Satyricon and
Cave-In, I believe.
Cave-In and Roland's Band and Immortal and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm actually into quite a lot of this.
I think you were saying The Kills. Did The Hives not do one? Because remember when Kerrang...
Oh, that would be... The Hives did one and The Kills were on it.
Kerrang loved The Hives. They were that crossover act. The curated discs, they kind of showed status for a magazine. It was a kind of humble brag if you could get somebody to do that. You know, I know that like Strokes and stuff did them for certain magazines. It helped the branding. It helped with the market placement of a magazine. So Kerrang really wanted to open itself up to stuff like The Hives because it was, you know, Kerrang came up as like a new wave of British heavy metal magazine to a lot of people. You know, it was like Iron Maiden and then also kind of stuff like Motorhead and that. And it tried to evolve, and getting a certain curator onto a disc, especially stuff like The Hives. And then later, I think they even went a bit lighter than that. Those kind of people helped broaden their audience, and it was kudos as well. It was a you know, a little high five for the staff to get somebody like that.
I think there was a bit of a hard on for Sweden as well.
There was Swedish rock and roll, and then Swedish thrash metal, and there was the crossover as well. Like Entombed were like this crossover band. From one end you went Helicopters and The Hives, and then the other end you went, you know, At The Gates.
Fucking love
The Haunted. But it's
I put together a wee list across the magazines. So when we're talking about the magazines, and probably like in our generation, it was Kerrang, Rock Sound, Terrorizer, maybe Mojo for you, Chris.
Metal Hammer,
Melody Maker.
Metal Hammer was the big one. Yeah, Melody Maker, NME and stuff. I didn't really fuck with them too much. My standard, because I guess we've been doing a lot of talking, so sticking some tunes here as well, which are very much of the era. One that really changed my life, maybe, was Slipknot, Eyeless.
You get to California with a mother, battles,
that came on us on the cover note CD.
Oh yeah, actually
a demo version of it.
I think Slipknot were on the first CD I had as well. It was Spit It Out.
And the same breath, I think Dig by Mudvayne was on there. Pretty Lush by Glassjaw. American Head Charge, Just So You Know, that was a standout. Lustmord and Wargasm, Raging Speedhorn, I think they were big in Vacant Stare. Bands like other kind of more low key, a band called Cecil, however you want to call it.
Yep.
They were big for me. I remember the only time I ever bought an uncut was on a flight to Canada, and I heard I heard Bright Eyes for the first time. I think he's cancelled now. And
Kelly
Joe Phelps, who's this amazing kind of country singer guitar player. This song called Not So Far to Go. Sleeping Johnny snores, dreaming oceans and whores, and all the while gluing tile on basement doors.
Mark's got newsflash. It's
Bright Eyes is not cancelled. No.
Bright Eyes is not cancelled. Mark can authoritatively
as an elder emo, I can say he survived.
What's he up to nowadays? Has he got a beard? And
he's got a new album coming out. But he did stuff with Phoebe Bridgers and just the regular music stuff, not the Ryan Adams stuff.
I don't know. I guess I still fuck with Ryan Adams.
He's definitely cancelled.
But I think, SoFi Bleed, 36 Crazy Fists. There was a demo of Circle the Drain.
Did we not do them for a Sound as a Pound?
Yes, we did. So Bitterness the Star. Yeah, I got Dave that for.
Yeah, we didn't mind it though. It was like just new metal to the fucking core.
Yeah. I minded it.
I liked the band. He had a weird voice. I think you guys might be talking about an early demo of mine soon. Quite similar in vocal stylings.
Spoiler alert.
Number One Son, Vacant Stare. These are all kind of UK kind of touring circuit bands.
Yep.
I think every one of these CDs had the skip tunes with bands like Kill to This and
Kill
like
to
that,
This.
You know?
Fuck me, man. Yeah. Holy shit. Forgot they even existed.
Yeah. I don't know, but these were the days when you would actually read the classifieds and all the rest of it. I remember the year after this, I went to the Big Day Out in Milton Keynes Bowl in 99. And that was, I think it was Metallica and Marilyn Manson headlining. And I basically bought a ticket out the back of a magazine and got picked up at Thistle Park on a bus and went all the way to Milton Keynes by myself. Came all the way back.
That could just as easily have been the start of a horror film as a festival.
Yeah, I was just sitting there like, writing in my journal and doing drawings on the bus the whole way. Oh, that's terrible. But yeah, there's some real standout tracks there that I really got into. At a Drive-In were one of them as well, Dave. But yeah, Glassjaw was probably my big takeaway. Glassjaw and Slipknot.
Well, we're talking about the curated side of it as well. How do you think they compare to curated playlists, right? Because to me, playlists are impermanent, right? They evolve constantly. They're easy to change. They don't acquire that sort of totemistic status and that sort of shared experience that I was talking about with friends who all get the same cover mount CD in the same week, and there's also that issue of white noise. There's so many playlists, there's so many options that the significance of a playlist, even if it's really good, is kind of diluted exponentially. You know, that one Kerrang Rock Sound Metal Hammer compilation of the week or month had a lot of clout, and even if a custom playlist is by somebody exceptional, it's one of millions. You know, it feels like that special shared experience thing just isn't there.
I looked into on the Discogs, like who put these, especially the one we're going to talk about. I looked into trying to find out who it was that put it together, and aside from the celeb ones kind of thing, which were kind of just tokenistic. I couldn't find out anything about them. So I think it was probably just staffers at the magazine who negotiated the deals and put this together. But there was no cachet to it or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that you sort of lose that shared cultural experience. But I mean, I guess we now live in a world with a lot more music than there was 20 years ago, and a lot more listenable music that has been released. And, you know, that... Well, we can talk about that if that means that music is worth less now, because...
You think much of the music for that era was listenable?
Well, I mean, no, what I'm saying is there's more listenable music now because more people are better and it's easier to release.
Yeah, not absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
But then there are obviously a lot more playlists and stuff like that. And it's obviously not as tangible as, oh yeah, that monthly CD that we all talk about. But I do still think that the quality shines through, because like there might be a specific, you know, playlist on Spotify that's like hip hop or trap or metal, like a metalcore playlist or something like that. And yeah, it's always evolving and changing and stuff like that. But when there's a standout track, you can tell people start listening to it and they talk about that. And that's where that shared sort of cultural thing still exists within playlists. You start noticing people are, you know, playing that at the club and you're like, oh, did you hear that on that playlist? So it's just a much more evolved, and it's not as nostalgic and it's not as, you know, cozy as sitting down to that CD, but it is more evolved, I think.
You're not necessarily, maybe it's not a bad thing, but you're not necessarily in 20, 25 years going to have a podcast or a show about playlists the same way you can have a podcast or a show about, you know.
No, I know, but that's because they are just not as specific. But there's probably more music, more better music getting put out there now than four good songs and eight dirge songs getting put out there once a month. Now there's like 2,000 good songs getting put out to 10 million people.
I totally agree, absolutely. And there's pros and cons, and I'd say probably more pros than cons, but it's a recurring theme on this show that a lot of the trends in music just now are resulting in a lack of permanence. And what I mean is like the permanence of experience. So here we've got another category where this is gone from the cultural milieu. You know what I mean? You no longer have the potential to talk about, oh my God, have you listened to this compilation? I had that. You had that. I had that. I'd never met you. We had the same thing. Oh my God, we had the same thing. Did you love this song? That commonality, that like, tiny insignificant little thing that ends up staying with you your whole life, and you find you have it in common with someone, and it sums up a whole moment of your life. I don't know about you folks, but when I was listening to that compilation, I was getting all these flashbacks of like being places I've forgotten had been, and being at shows, and oh, I saw them and stuff. That it's another aspect. It's just one more aspect of music that we're finding is impermanent now. It doesn't have a lifespan, and that's one thing we've constantly come across, is that a lot of the trends are leading to just throwaway, disposable, temporary, fleeting nature of things. And I'm not trying to put a moral or a qualitative judgment on that, although I suppose there's one implied, but I just think that's an interesting thing. This is another corner of music that is not going to have any sort of enduring. But it might, but I think
the music itself will endure.
Yeah, but the playlists, the shared thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also, there's another dynamic which I just want to throw in before I shut up, but is that borders are no longer an issue. One of the big things about these discs was that people were trying to break bands in territories. Mm. So the Korn release over here, the X band, suddenly you're like, who is this band? Oh, these guys are huge in America, and now they're on this compilation over here. They're trying to get traction here. The playlists are sort of much more internationalized.
It depends where they come from. Like Spotify UK's playlist is all UK acts, you know what I mean? So, and those ones are huge and listened to by hundreds of thousands of people. Yeah, I mean, I do agree with some of what you're saying, but also the other side of me is like, we're just too fucking old at this point. Like, no one's going to be talking about, no one's going to be having that conversation after us. It's gone forever, you know?
Yeah, we could also have a podcast about, you know, retro games or floppy disk drives or something like that. And, like, they were fun, but there's no point in them anymore. We are older.
It's kind of sad to think that for some of these bands, being on one of these compilations was the highlight of their...
Oh, yeah, totally.
Definitely
I was on a cover mount of Metal Hammer with Fear Factory or something like that. That's my kind of cultural contribution to the world.
There's no question that's going to be a recurring observation as well, because there is a tragic quality to it. The only thing I would say is with that analogy you said about the video games, what you will have in 20 years is people saying, oh my God, you played Skyrim, I played Skyrim as well. Oh my God, you played World of Warcraft online, I played World of Warcraft. There is a shared experience there. The analogy doesn't hold. The music doesn't necessarily have that same shared experience. You know what I mean?
Oh my God, Chris, you and I were in World War II.
Well, or three.
There might be some of the shared experience of, like, do you remember seeing that Justin Bieber video? The first time that resonated with me, do you know what I mean? Like, that could be...
Yeah, do you remember when WAP came out during lockdown? Yeah, everybody was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So much.
Yeah, but that's always been there anyway. We're talking about something in addition. Yeah, yeah. You know, do you remember when Rod Stewart brought out "Do You Think I'm Sexy"? You know, I'm sure people.
Yeah, but
had
do you remember when that video of? Do you remember when that video of the man falling over on TikTok happened and everybody was listening to that song?
That's true. I mean, yeah, there you
so,
go.
So you know, these shared experiences are there. You're just not experiencing them because you're an old cunt.
But you've made a point. But again, qualitatively, I'm just going to let it speak for itself. Is that the shared experience of things like collections of music and that has been replaced by Guy Falls Over on TikTok?
No, it's been glib. There is creativity on TikTok.
You're being glib, but also
these young people are having these shared experiences. Like, you know, if you look at like a Billie Eilish concert or something like that, this is young people coming together. Young people would have came together at a Pantera Stadium concert back in the early 90s kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Same thing, different fucking recipe. People are still having these experiences and we're just not privy to them because, as Dave said, we're all kind.
Chink, Billy Eilish likes white wine as well.
yeah, it's just a different medium now, especially with lockdown, things being online, all the rest of it. We see it as a bit glib, you know, like bands doing a concert from the living room or something like that, or some highly produced kind of concert in a venue. It's
two folk,
just a different thing.
Two folk meet in a bar in New Zealand in fucking 3 decades. Oh, did you watch that dreary cunt sitting on the edge of his bed playing an acoustic guitar cover of Creep as well? Mm. I remember those years, I remember the days.
That was lockdown. That was my whole lockdown.
Did you listen to that unsung podcast?
Yeah, that'll be it.
Those three Scottish guys.
We are music's last hope.
Did you want to talk anything about the notion of free music? Because this is kind of what...
You mentioned that earlier. It's interesting.
It kind of came to my mind thinking about it. Like, was this the beginning of the end? Because although you were buying the magazine, it said free CD. And even though, as you said, sometimes a magazine price would double to, in those days, showing her age, it would be like £3 or something for like a Metal Hammer. And you were getting like 18 to 20 tracks or 15 on the regular of free music. Was that something that psychologically kind of affected people being like, this music is free? Even though you're getting maybe 4 tracks from some of the biggest bands of the era, mm-hmm. and then maybe another 10 tracks of, you know, wishy-washy, take it or leave it dirge. But was that the start? Because I know this is around the time when file sharing and Napster and LimeWire and all that were all coming out as well, but was this a kind of a collective change in consciousness where, like, music can be free or music is free or music's not worth...
Oh, it's like a devaluation of the art form.
Yeah, definitely. And do government CDs really contribute to that? The Mike Oldfield thing that Chris was talking about earlier on, I think EMI put out that he had a 30% increase in sales of his actual album, even with the free CD of 2.8 million or whatever was sent out. It's a strange kind of...
It's a weird balance, then. And I definitely think there's two sides to that coin. It's funny, I was reading an article by Campaign magazine or website, and it was from 2005, and it was talking about free CD cover mounts are everywhere, showcasing almost every form of music imaginable. But are they pushing sales, or, as many in the industry believe, killing the business? And then it's like a fairly serious report from a marketing perspective. Are free CDs harming or, you know, helping the music business? And it's interesting reading the guy who wrote this, because I just don't think they're a music fan. So they're like, oh yeah, I bought the cover mount CD on Uncut and it was pretty good. It was worth the £350. You're like, all right. Then he would, you know, talk about like, oh, Daily Star is giving away a soul album. That's fine. I spent 50p on it. There's a Christmas album on the Daily Mail. It's probably worth buying that rather than a Christmas record. Like, are you maybe stopping non-music fans from buying their one CD every 6 months But on the flip side to that, as we've talked about, Covermount CDs introduced you to so many records. Off the back of Covermount CDs, I've probably gone and spent, you know, thousands of pounds on albums, you know, over a decade. So to me, Covermount CDs were invaluable to the music industry because they introduced me to music. Like, you know, once Prince starts putting it on the front of the Daily Mail, I think you then can start talking about, are you devaluing music?
The red top newspapers were doing it as well, you know, like your 40 pence Daily Star and shit.
But then you've got to follow up with, you know, Radiohead and say, did they then devalue it, even though that was an interesting concept, blah, blah, blah. I think the compilation Covermount album on a music magazine, I think that valued music.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just going to say, I think there's maybe an argument for there having been like a Goldilocks period. I'm mindful, though, there'll be a big asterisk on that, that it also meant there were tastemakers and gatekeepers, and the gatekeepers were the magazines, which perhaps became too powerful because of it. But yet, as you say, it probably did promote sales. Mm-hmm. And that was a really, like, profitable period for the record industry in the early days of this. Yeah. And bearing in mind that we've said it happened all the way through the 60s, 70s and 80s to a more primitive extent via cassettes and flexi discs. But when the CDs came in, it really like took off for a period. Then it seems like it got so saturated that it really did start to become somewhat counterproductive. I also think it's interesting that the first iteration that I used of file sharing was the likes of Epitonic. Now, it was kind of limited by the broadband speed, but Epitonic took what I would say is quite close to the Covermount format. They invited bands to submit one song, and or one song per record, shall we say. And so you would be able to download, say, four or five Blonde Redhead songs. In my case, that's where I first heard them, right? And download the tracks and you'd be like, oh, I like that one, what album's that on? And then go and get the album. And sometimes you had to leave your computer on overnight to download that. I was using a mate's computer, in fact, to download that. That was a nice period because it was easy to access the stuff internationally. It sort of emulated the Covermount thing in that the bands were putting their best foot forward, they had a say in it, and yes, okay, they lost a bit of money on that song, but ultimately it encouraged me to invest in a whole load of other music, including almost all of the Constellation Records stuff I got via that, or got into via that. So I do think that was a really nice period. But then obviously when broadband speeds increased and people were insatiable, they were like, I don't want a song, I want the whole album, and I don't want to pay for it, I don't want to go out and pay for it. So it's probably a human nature rather than the format.
I also just think the music industry tried to stop it rather than like grow with it and evolve with it.
What I find really interesting about this whole thing is, like, we've all obviously did a minimal amount of research in this, but I couldn't find anything on the economics of how this all worked for the bands. So it's probably a complete label thing. Yeah. It'd be interesting if, before we get to episode two, if some of the guests that you've had on the programme who have had songs on Covermount CDs, maybe hit them up for a quote, really, as to how that worked and how that worked for them as artists. Because there's no information out there, it seems like there might be a bit of a dirty secret there or something. I don't really know how it works.
The podcast we mentioned earlier on,
the We Dig Music Guys, and
Free with this month's issue, I think it's called.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as I say, they are also trying to get behind the scenes and work out what exactly was going on. And, you know, maybe between the two of us, we can actually get somewhere with that at some point.
Mm-hmm. You can call up the guy from In Me, ask him.
Oh, God, yeah. I don't think we're on talking terms after that episode. So I think that kind of brings us to the chin wagging about the actual concept of cover discs. So what we're going to do next week is take a specific Covermount CD, and in this case quite an iconic one, which we chose because I think it's got a lot to chat about within it. And that disc is, Dave?
It is Radio Kerrang 5.
Volume 5.
Volume 5. And it's from February 1998.
Mm-hmm. And I was only 11 years old.
I was 16. Chris was 37.
I was 6 months old. No, I was 12, I think. 13, maybe.
Craig would get home for a day down the mines and stick that disc on his stolen CD player.
Had to get up 2 hours before you go to work.
Right, we will discuss that and review it as we might any normal album, and we'll see what happens. It should be a grand old time.